Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f-. So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And is all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Hi there, and welcome to the Explaining History podcast. And today I want to take a dip into the bigger kind of picture of economic history in the 20th century. I know from time to time I do this, and we kind of step back a bit and look at a kind of a global context in a given time frame. And I want to look at the period 1978 to about 1980. And the advent of neoliberalism. I've done a few podcasts on this before, but the reason why I keep returning to this is because, as far as pivotal moments in economic history go, 78 to 80, perhaps even up to 83, 84, can't be overstated for its significance. It might even be thought of as a period of economic revolution, or certainly a revolutionary turning point, as David Harvey puts it in his amazing book, A Brief History of Neoliberalism, which, if you haven't read it and you are interested in macroeconomic histories, it's an extremely good one. I'd rate it alongside The State We're In by Will Hutton, which was one of those kind of watershed books of the 1990s. David Harvey writes, "Future historians may well look upon the years 1978 to 1980 as a revolutionary turning point in the world's social and economic history. In 1978, Deng Xiaoping took the first momentous steps towards the liberalisation of a communist-ruled economy in a country that accounted for 1/5 of the world's population. The path that Deng defined was to transform China in 2 decades from a closed backwater to an open centre of capitalist dynamism with sustained growth rates unparalleled in human history. On the other side of the Pacific, in a quite different circumstances, a relatively obscure but now renowned figure named Paul Volcker," — I have actually done a podcast on Paul Volcker previously, check it out — "took command at the US Federal Reserve in July 1979, within a few months dramatically changed monetary policy. The Fed thereafter took the lead in the fight against inflation, no matter what its consequences, particularly as concerned unemployment. Across the Atlantic, Margaret Thatcher had already been elected Prime Minister of Britain in May 1979, with a mandate to curb trade union power and put an end to the miserable inflationary stagnation that enveloped the country for the preceding decade. Then, in 1980, Ronald Reagan was elected President of the US, and armed with geniality and personal charisma, set the US on the course to revitalise its economy by supporting Volcker's moves at the Fed and adding his own particular blend of policies to curb the power of labour, deregulate industry, agriculture and resource extraction, and liberate the powers of finance, both internally and on the world stage. From these several epicentres, revolutionary impulses seemingly spread and reverberated to remake the world around in a totally different image. So it's interesting from what David Harvey is saying there that there were diverse revolutionary epicentres. And if you also consider the neoliberal laboratory in the early 1970s of Pinochet's Chile, the beginnings of neoliberalism are extremely diverse, from post-Maoist China to Margaret Thatcher. And throughout the 80s and 90s, of course, neoliberalism features in most of the world's economies. It spreads far more effectively than communism had done in the early 20th century. The other point that's interesting here is some of the defining features of neoliberalism. And if you want to try to sum it up, you know, the reinvention of classic liberal economics. Well, classic liberal economics, neoliberalism incorporates some of their some aspects of classic of liberal economics, particularly the workings of free markets. The aspects of neoliberalism that are important are were defined in the changes in Reagan's America and Thatcher's Britain, were the breaking of organised labour and the deregulation, the reduction in government control over industry, but more importantly, over finance. And David Harvey adds here agriculture and resource extraction. So ultimately what this means is that neoliberalism is an enormous transition of power from labour to capital. And this seemingly upended much of the post-war period, where a commitment to full employment had existed in Britain, in America, and in much of the Europe of the social democratic moment, as defined by Tony Judd in his book Post-War. The power of labour, the relative power of labour, and it wasn't an enormous power, had come under sustained intellectual and journalistic assault throughout the post-war era, in the 50s, 60s, and particularly the 70s, in Britain and America. And by the 1970s, a variety of right-wing think tanks, such as the Institute for Economic Affairs in Britain, were capable of moving neoliberal ideas, the ideas of economists such as Friedrich von Hayek and Milton Friedman, from the unacceptable fringes of economic thought that had been seen as the kind of the preserve of cranks and crackpots, right to the centre ground of economics, a centre ground of economic debate. This was possible because the material conditions for this were present. The inflation of the 1970s and the subsequent union unrest showed that things like full employment policies, or policies that allowed for a certain amount of inflation in return for other favourable economic circumstances, such as low levels of unemployment, that these were not working. By the mid-1970s, not only do you get rising unemployment, rising inflation, but by 1976, unemployment in Great Britain tops the 1 million mark. Now, by the early 1980s, when unemployment had topped the 3 million mark, something that had never happened during the Great Depression of the 1930s, the problems of the 1970s seem relatively trivial. But what the 1970s and the in Britain, the last year of the 1970s, and the winter of 1978 to 1979 showed to the British public was that trade union power was had got radically out of hand. The power of the unions seemed to have to bring the country to a standstill with strikes was no doubt formidable at that point in time. And it was, you know, it must be remembered that it was a Labour, not a Conservative government, that was brought down by the strikes. And it was, this was an increasingly centre-right Labour government that under Callaghan and Healey had begun to adopt many of the basic precepts of neoliberal economics long before Margaret Thatcher had arrived in Downing Street. But it was, the unions brought the government to its knees, and an election in May 1979 ended a period in British history that had begun in 1945 with the advent of Margaret Thatcher and the gradual destruction of consensus politics. Some might argue that that consensus had begun to break down from the 1960s onwards. Anyway, the point being that when Margaret Thatcher stepped into 10 Downing Street, she stepped into 10 Downing Street with a mandate to break the power of organised labour, to deal a death blow to union power. She didn't really campaign on privatisation. That wasn't a term that was used by her at the time. She campaigned on a low level of denationalisation, but that wasn't one of her key aims. The idea that there was a manifesto in 1979 full of arguments about creating more responsive and labour markets, deregulating finance and letting the city off the leash, that didn't really exist at that point. At that point, Margaret Thatcher was an adherent, even by 1975. She was an adherent of Friedrich von Hayek, and when asked in 1975 what does the Conservative Party believe, apocryphally she waved a copy of von Hayek's book The Road to Serfdom and said, "This is what we believe." Von Hayek is an interesting character in this entire story, and I have devoted quite a few podcasts to him previously, so I don't want to kind of go on at length about him here. But von Hayek and his contemporaries who had fled Austria under the right-wing dictator Dollfuss, and then following that they had been unable to return after the Anschluss, von Hayek found a home in Britain, and from the 30s and the 40s onwards began to popularise the idea that all states were inherently tyrannical, and that state power itself, be it communist or fascist or even social democratic, was inherently at odds with individual freedom, and that the only force that was capable of having some kind of objective truth, or being able to perceive some kind of objective truth, was the force of the market. And the way he thought of it was like this. He said, well, one individual on their own cannot really understand the world because their experience is subjective. They only see what they see. A state, a government with its branches of judiciary and police and civil service and all that, again, is unable to accurately and objectively understand the world because it is an institution that relies on its own power. But the organisation of human beings that is best able to be, you know, almost like a collective intelligence, a greater intelligence, is the market. If everyone decides that the maximum they'll pay for a cup of coffee is £1.50, then that is an objective truth about the worth of that good or service. And therefore, getting in the way of markets, allowing doing anything to interfere with the communication of price signals and the workings of labour markets through labour prices and all the rest, if anybody tampers with markets, they're effectively taking away individual freedoms, and the growth of the state is the greatest threat to individual freedom. That's really the road to serfdom kind of condensed, but you get the idea. Margaret Thatcher is a funny kind of neoliberal to begin with, really, in that she believed quite emphatically in state power in certain regards. She believed in the return to traditional values and the rule of law. The 1970s had been not only a period of union unrest, but also of kind of IRA terrorism. And there had been an overall belief in Britain that the rule of law and respect for one's elders and all these sorts of things was really in decline.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.
Fine. So her appeal was in the destruction of organised labour, or at least the reduction of union power, and a rather more emotional appeal to a return to a Britain that seemed to have evaporated or have been lost. Very little of what she argued at that time or articulated to the public, and even less in terms of what the public actually absorbed and embraced, was the unleashing of market forces and the belief and faith in market fundamentalism. That was really part two of Thatcherism from 1984 onwards. One fundamental difference between Chinese neoliberalism and Anglo-American neoliberalism is that Anglo-American neoliberalism, the Thatcher-Reaganite consensus, was really dressed up in the language of individual freedom. Deng Xiaoping was not discussing any such thing, and the idea of extending notions of, particularly European Enlightenment notions of individual freedom to China, was not on his agenda whatsoever. Put simply, markets were a way of achieving prosperity, and prosperity could be thought of as socialism. Deng famously made the point that poverty was not socialism, and that whatever Mao had brought about during the Cultural Revolution, the chaos and the violence and the destruction of property and the total disruption of everyday life and the hunger and, in some cases, starvation that went with it, whatever you could call that, it did not achieve socialism. It simply achieved poverty and chaos. Therefore, the embrace of markets and the dramatic extension of private ownership didn't go hand in hand with notions of freedom and liberty, and it certainly didn't go hand in hand with any kind of reduction in state power. One of the great ironies of the Reagan and Thatcher era is that the state did not shrink in either case, the state grew. And the ideas proposed by Hayek didn't really come to fruition. Certainly, nationalised industries in Great Britain were sold and exposed to market forces to some extent, and the role of the state dramatically transformed, but it didn't shrink. One possible reason for that could be looking at the development of capitalism from the late 17th century onwards. At each moment where private ownership has expanded in Britain, the state has created the means for that to happen. When private ownership of common land was established, there had to be the kind of legal infrastructure and the policing for that to occur. So markets don't emerge in the absence of state power. Markets emerge very often because of state power, and that during the 1980s, a period of intense social conflict, the role of the police, the judiciary, social services, and aspects of the welfare state are key in creating the conditions amongst the labour force, the economy, and the society at large to allow markets to operate as freely as possible. The kinds of economic and social change and the pace of that change, very rarely do these things happen without the aid of state power. One of the key reasons for neoliberalism in China was that Deng Xiaoping was acutely aware of the economic successes of Japan, Hong Kong, Taiwan, South Korea, and other Asian tigers, and he felt that China was surrounded by these nations that had large cash surpluses. They were economies that were successfully exporting to the to Europe and to America, and that economies with cash to spend and surpluses of it need to invest, and the eventuality would be that they would find ways to invest in China, to set up factories and to extract wealth from China. Far better, thought Deng, was to create their special enterprise zones and to attract overseas investment on Chinese terms. So what that tells us about Chinese neoliberalism is that it emerges within the context of a wider Asian rejuvenation. In the amazing book Forgotten Wars by Tim Harper and Christopher Bailey, they argue that the war in Asia, the Second World War in Asia, continues until the throughout the 1940s and into the 1950s, and it's in the Asia is a period of immense unrest all the way through the 60s and 70s, and it's really the economic renaissance of Japan. And Japan is eventually a neoliberal state emerging that finally brings some kind of stability to Asia. And this would make sense, having an economic surplus state in a particular region acts as almost a kind of a linchpin to the economy, much as Germany had done, West Germany had done in Western Europe from the 50s, the mid-50s onwards. And perhaps neoliberalism itself was a doctrine that could be reasonably articulated and propagated in a period of scientific and economic advancement in the second half of the 20th century. It's an idea that essentially could be advanced when the material conditions for individual self-propagation and advancement were there. David Harvey says, neoliberalism is, in the first instance, a theory of political and economic practices that proposes that human well-being can best be advanced by liberating individual entrepreneurial freedoms and skills within an institutional framework characterized by strong private property rights, free markets, and free trade. All the kinds of things you need powerful governments for, by the way. The role of the state is to create and preserve an institutional framework appropriate to such practices. The state has to guarantee, for example, the quality and integrity of money. It must also set up those military, defence, political and legal structures and functions required to secure private property rights and to guarantee, by force if need be, the proper functioning of markets. Furthermore, if markets do not exist in areas such as land, water, education, healthcare, social security or environmental pollution, then they must be created by state action if necessary. But beyond these tasks, the state should not venture. State interventions in markets, once created, must be kept to a bare minimum because, according to the theory, the state cannot possibly possess enough information to second-guess market signals, and because the powerful interest groups will inevitably distort and bias state interventions, particularly in democracies, for their own benefit. Now, 2008 really is the postscript to all of this. This is the bookend at the end of the neoliberal era. High neoliberalism, you might say, lasted from 1989 to 2008, following the fall of communism and the introduction of neoliberal capitalism with catastrophic effects into Russia, which is something I want to tackle in great depth later on. Tony Judd, in his book Ill Fares the Land, famously said that 1989 was a great missed opportunity, much as 1918 and the Treaty of Versailles had been, and perhaps had there been some kind of international settlement between the victorious West and the former communist world, things might be considerably better than they are now. The 2008 was that watershed moment when the deregulation of finance, its chickens came home to roost. One might say that from 2008 to 2017 we have existed in a kind of post-ideological wasteland. Economically speaking, there is no defining ideology that makes any sense anymore, that the idea that markets can do pretty much everything and we should simply trust them has gone out of the window for most people. An idea that a generation ago was hegemonic, i.e. believed as absolute common sense, is now one that is rejected in ever greater numbers. The only problem being, of course, that a new economic doctrine has yet to come and replace it. That leads us to the old Gramscian refrain about, and I paraphrase here, about how when one economic system has died and another is yet to be born in the middle, exists a morbid symptom. And the growth of fascistic nationalisms around the world, from Trump in America to Viktor Orban in Hungary to Narendra Modi in India, and to the vast plethora of right-wing Brexiteers that we have to endure here in Great Britain, is evidence that this Gramscian idea may well hold water. Neoliberalism intellectually was the product of a reaction to the totalitarianisms of the 20th century, and has created perhaps not totalitarianisms, but authoritarian states in their own right, dedicated to the protection of these rather precious and fragile markets. And when the markets themselves cease to function because of huge distortions, huge disparities in market power, meaning that obviously there are winners and losers within market economies, the system starts to fragment and has to be based on increasing levels of debt. One of the key aspects of neoliberalism in Britain and America particularly is the destruction of labour power, meant that there was little scope for wage bargaining, and that meant that low-wage economies had to have increasing levels of debt and increasing levels of financial liberalisation, the ability to lend money to people who had never been lent money previously, to keep the system going through consumer spending. And hey presto, we reach levels of debt that are unserviceable. Paul Mason recently wrote that debt was really kind of like a letter to the future, that one normally allows large quantities of debt to accumulate on the understanding that future earnings and future GDP will pay it back. Unfortunately, the future that we are facing in the 21st century, partly due to the advent of the internet, AI and new technologies, is going to be one of low growth and low GDP. So how we pay that one back is anyone's guess. Anyway, we're starting to look into the future here and not the past, so that rather starts to fray at the edges of what the Explaining History podcast is meant to do. But I've gone on for long enough, so this is a kind of an extra Christmas treat, a half-hour podcast instead of a 25-minute one. I hope you all have a wonderful Christmas. I'm going to sign off for the year now. Thanks so much for everyone who's listened and who's contributed, who's messaged me, and who's been part of Explaining History this year. We've really grown. I'm very, very grateful, and I hope you all have a happy Christmas and a restful New Year.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Did you know cats tend to hide symptoms of sickness and pain? I learned this the hard way after losing my cat, Gingy. So I created Pretty Litter, a health monitoring litter that helps detect early signs of illness by changing colors, saving you money and potentially your cat's life. Pretty Litter is veterinarian developed, and it's the easiest way to keep tabs on your fur baby's health right at home.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
Hey everyone, Craig Robinson here. I want you to check out the Ways to Win podcast, brought to you by Ford and the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. On Ways to Win, Coach Cal and I will discuss leadership lessons we've learned. We know all about the days spent perfecting your craft outside of the limelight and have knowledge to share about how strength, inspiration, encouragement, and adaptability are the key ingredients to drive toward your dreams. And those same ingredients can be found in the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. So check out my podcast, Ways to Win, and also check out the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. Learn more at Ford.com. Built Ford tough, built Ford proud.